Nearly 70% of the Jewish citizens of Israel belong now to a category which Israeli demographers and sociologists call the Eidot HaMizrahi, the communities of the East. It's actually, because of the geography, which is suggested, a strange term. The largest group of the Eidot HaMizrahi are the Jews whose origins are in Morocco, and every one of them was born west of the entire continent of Europe. And there's also something rather condescending about the term. There is no corresponding term. No one uses the term Eidot HaMaravi, the Western communities, which would be the appropriate term for those Jews whose origins, whose roots lie in Europe, whether or not they then have subsequently moved to North America, to the South Africa, South America. We call those Jews simply Ashkenazi, the Jews who come out of the great Central European heartland, the German Jews. And therefore, I think we really ought to call the Jews of the Eidot HaMizrahi simply Sephardim, the Spanish Jews. Because what we're talking about is not an East-West differentiation, but one between the North and the South. One between those Jews who have lived in an environment where the basic host culture was Christian and European, and one who have lived in an environment whose basic culture is Islamic and Arabic. And these are the Jews, these Sephardi, from North Africa, from the southern shores of the Mediterranean, from the Middle East, from India, Southeast Asia, the Philippines, whose lives have been led, at least for the last 1,000 years, largely within a culture permeated by, dominated by, Islamic forms of political organization, of law, and of culture. And what is unique about the Sephardim is that though they represent but a minority outside of Israel, as I suggested in my opening statement, they represent by far the majority, a growing majority within the state. If we were to take a census of origins of the Jewish community of Cleveland, I doubt that we would find more than several hundred families whose origins go back to this Sephardi world. Most of us are Ashkenazim, whether our roots are in Central European, some Central European country, or an Eastern European country. And we've really taken for granted that there's something natural, right, and proper about being Ashkenazic. This is the way Jews should be. But if we look back over time, look back, say, to the year 1000, we would discover that at that point, 97% of all the Jews in the world were Sephardim. There was only a very small minority of other Jews. That it wasn't until the 17th century that there came to be population parity between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim. And that during the 18th century, the Ashkenazic population grew by 50%, the Sephardic population of the world remained fairly constant. And then we suffered enjoyed our own population explosion in the 19th century, when Ashkenazic Jewry quadrupled in numbers and Sephardic Jewry remained essentially as it had been. And the reasons, of course, go to the basic systemic changes which were taking place in Europe at the time. This was a Europe after the Age of Discovery, after the Age of the Enlightenment. This was the Europe of the Industrial Revolution. This was the Europe in which medicine was beginning to take hold. This was a Europe which had become the dominant force in our world. All the while, the Arab lands, the Islamic lands, slumbered on in what really was a continuation of medievalism. The great explosion of Islamic culture had been in the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. And then, for whatever reasons, they had not been able to move technology, science, invention, civilization ahead. And they had fallen back into a kind of medieval sleepiness from which they've only begun to emerge in our own times. And so by the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century, Ashkenazic Jewry represented by far the dominant force in world Jewry. Probably 80%+ of the Jews of the world were Ashkenazim. And our forms, our ideas, our experiences have shaped us and made us, for better or for worse, what we are. And of course, the facts of the general Jewish world population can be replicated within the history of Israel itself. Until the middle of the 19th century, the control of Israel, the general Jewish population of Palestine, was Sephardi. The Hashem Bashi, the chief rabbi of the Sephardic community, was a representative of those Jews of Sfat and of Jerusalem to the Ottoman court. And it wasn't until the age of imperialism, to the middle of the 19th century, when Ashkenazic money and Ashkenazic yeshivot began to descend in large numbers upon the holy cities of Palestine, when they became, because of the backing which they enjoyed in Europe, when they became the dominant force, that Ashkenazic life began to make an impress on Palestine. And then shortly thereafter, of course, there was the arrival of the first Aliyah, the young 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old Jews of Russia, Poland, Eastern Europe, who, motivated by a series of socialist ideas, pioneering ideas, began the modern Zionist resettlement of the Holy Land. Now, it was the resettlement, of course, which brought to Israel this great Sephardic immigration. The Sephardim seemed fairly well rooted in their environment. There was no corresponding movement among the Sephardim to Zionism among the Ashkenazim. Zionism emerged in part because of the immemorial love of Zion, which is so elemental in our approach to our religious tradition, and in part because of anti-Semitism. In part because the promise of emancipation could not be, was not fulfilled in Europe. And the Jews of Europe felt frustrated. They wanted to join the forces of the new. They shared much of the ideology of the reformist, the radical forces of Europe. But they found that anti-Semitism was endemic on the left as on the right, among the revolutionaries as among the Tsarist forces. And so there developed quickly among Jews a recognition that we would have to have our own homeland, our own place, and they set out to recreate that place and to create in Zion an entirely new social order. And so these were Jews who came to create Zion. They were Jews who came without the burden or the blessing of the religious tradition. They were mostly socialist ideologues, convinced atheists or agnostics, who looked upon religion, as Marx had, as a kind of opiate, a deadening of the forces of activism in this time and place. They came because in Europe there was no hope. You had to get the Jews out of Europe and Europe out of the Jews, and they would create in Zion a new home. And they created in Zion a new home. But in doing so, unexpectedly and really without having thought the consequences of what they were doing, they unsettled the Jews of the Edot HaMizrahi, the Sephardic Jews of the Islamic world. The life of these Jews was not a happy one. They were tolerated. They were not citizens. In many places, they lived lives under the control and sometimes being actively oppressed by the dominant majority. But a modus vivendi had more or less been established in most parts of the Sephardic world. And now, because some were moved by Zionist and Messianic hopes, because others were removed forcibly from their homes by the passionate anti-Israel, anti-Jewish attitudes which developed as the state was coming into being in Egypt, in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, and places like that, a great outpouring of Jews from the Sephardic world descended upon Israel in the years 49 through 56. And unlike the Ashkenazic Jews who came there, these Jews not only moved from their ancient home to Israel, a geographic movement, but they moved in time from a world which was for most of them largely medieval into a world which was modern or postmodern. It was a difficult adjustment. Immigration always is. But when, in addition, you have to adjust to new forms, new institutions, new attitudes, new ideologies, for most, the adjustment is almost beyond human achievement. And so these Jews came. When the Ashkenazim came, whether they came before the Second World War or were the survivors of the Holocaust, they came to a society not that unlike the society they'd left behind. They found in that society relatives, distant or close, and many moved as soon as they could, close to those with whom they were, to whom they were related. When the Sephardim came, they found no one from their families. And they found themselves in a world of democratic institutions. They found themselves in a world where the state could be trusted. You were the state, and the state was you. They found themselves, however, also in a world which could not provide for them the kind of cultural and social integration which might have eased the change. They came at a time of desperate economic need for Israel. You remember the late 40s and early 50s was the era of the Ma'barot, of the great camps into which these immigrants were placed. There was almost no employment for them. They came as extended families, and it was very difficult for Israel to adjust to the kind of housing needs that they had. And so instead of integrating them into the society at large, the decision was made largely to move them from the Ma'barot as soon as possible into what were called development towns, Dimona, Kfar Saba, places like that. New communities, which sprung into being out of nothing, and because they came into being out of nothing, could provide very little in the way of culture and less in the way of employment, or at least high-level employment, for these people. And so these people were, in a sense, in Israel, but not of Israel. And the Israelis looked to their educational system to the army, which is in Israel, part of the educational system, to integrate the Sephardim into the larger culture. Now, those who came were an interesting cross-section of the Sephardim. The Sephardic community, as it developed in the 19th century in Egypt, in the Middle East, and in North Africa, had been a two-class community. There had been those who had quickly appreciated what the colonial powers were doing in terms of bringing new instrumentalities of finance and merchandising, commerce, and manufacture, and had become, in a sense, the agents of the colonial, the French, the Dutch, the Germans, the English, in these countries, and had prospered with them. And these people who had had a generation or two or three to adjust to Western ways, by and large, when they were forced to leave their homelands, left for Europe or for North America. While those who came were the village Jews, the proletarian Jews, if one can use this term to describe the urban impoverished of these countries, the people who lived in the melas. And these are the ones who came, and they came without a great deal. They had been craftsmen they had been small-time shopkeepers. Each had had a very specific skill, but they had very little by way of the knowledge required to adjust to a modern technological state. So Israel was faced with a problem of integration, a problem of communities came without their natural leaders, if you will. It faced a problem which it tried to adjust to largely by demanding that this Sephardic immigration become Israeli, which meant Ashkenazic, which meant European. Israel made all of the mistakes that the United States made during the early part of the century. You remember when the great immigration waves, of which most of our grandparents and great-grandparents were part, came, the dominant theory was that America was to be a melting pot. And those who talked of the melting pot really didn't mean that somehow each group would give to the whole the best that it had to give. It meant that the distinctiveness of the individual group, of the Poles, the Slavs, the Italians, the Germans, the Jews, the Irish, and so on, would be melted down, and out of that somehow would become people who replicated the characteristics of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant who had dominated the American cultural scene for the past century. In Israel, the same assumptions occurred. They looked at these impoverished people. They looked at these people who came out of a medieval environment, and they said, we've got to make Israelis out of them. We've got to make Europeans out of them. And they worried in a very arrogant kind of way about what would happen to Israel if they didn't succeed in this process. Abba Ibn, you all know him? His Oxford-educated speech has impressed endless American audiences, but he has all the arrogance, the instinctive arrogance of the West. And so in the late 60s, we find him saying, "One of the great apprehensions which afflict us when we contemplate our cultural scene is the danger lest the predominance of immigrants of Oriental origin force Israel to equalize its cultural level with that of the neighboring world. So far from regarding our immigrants from Oriental countries as a bridge towards our integration with the Arab-speaking world, our object should be to infuse them with the Occidental spirit, rather than to allow them to drag us into an unnatural Orientalism." And Golda Meir, the great grandmother figure of American Jews, two American Jews, wondered aloud, "Shall we be able to elevate these immigrants to a suitable level of civilization?" Now, if you go to Amsterdam and you look at the synagogues of Amsterdam, you'll be shown the great Sephardi synagogue. A synagogue which is as large, as glorious as any of the Jews have created around the world. And you'll hear of the great Sephardic community, of its contributions to the creation of North America through the West Indian Company. You'll hear about Spinoza. You hear about Uriel da Costa. You hear about Manasseh ben Israel. And if you go to the records of our Supreme Court, you'll hear of Benjamin Cardoza, a Sephardic Jew. You go to New York, you can visit the Sherit Yisrael, the Sephardic congregation, one of the oldest congregations in America, a congregation whose membership numbers among the elite of our ancestors here in this country. Sephardic Jewry has a long, proud history. Moses Maimonides was Hasfaradi, the Sephardic Jew. The great golden age in Spain, which was one of the greatest of the moments of cultural efflorescence our people has ever known, was all created by and the creation of Sephardic Jews. The Sephardim have and have always had a high level of culture, but it's different than the Ashkenazic culture. Now, one can understand how Mr. Eban, looking down from his Oxford background, looked upon these impoverished people with their extended families, some of them with still practicing polygamy, many of the women particularly illiterate, and how he would wonder if they could become part of an Israeli, a modern society. And Golda Meir's problem was more, I suspect, political than cultural. Because as the numbers of the Sephardim grew, since Israel is a democracy, inevitably this had significant consequences for the political scene. And first in the development towns and later in society at large, the Sephardim began to demand their place in the sun. Now, the Sephardim brought with them an entirely different cultural and historic experience than the Ashkenazim. When the Sephardim came to Israel, they knew nothing of the concepts of class war, class struggle. They knew nothing of socialism, Marx, Engels, nothing of the Zionist socialists, of Moses Hess and Ber Borodchev and men of that kind. They came out of an environment in which they were, for the most part, satisfied with a mercantilist economy. They were much less political activists in the sense of believing that one could achieve with one's own efforts a totally new kind of social order. They more patiently awaited the coming of the Messiah. They looked upon Ashkenazic Jewish life with a degree of disdain. Now, it's interesting, if you read the literature of those who rebelled against their Jewish background, you find certain themes run through it, certain themes which spoiled the American literature, American novels in the 10 and 20 years ago. The Philip Roths and the others who rebelled against their Jewish background, what did they rebel against? They rebelled against over-emotionalism. They rebelled against vulgarity. They rebelled against the noisiness of the synagogue, the lack of piety. They rebelled against the lack of dignity within the context of the family. And it's precisely those qualities which Sephardic Jewry has always emphasized. If you go to a Sephardic service in Morocco or in Israel, you go into a service not unlike our own, where there's quiet and dignity, where everyone is saying the same prayers at the same time, when there's a quality of aesthetic decorum throughout all that takes place. And if you go into a Sephardic home, no matter how impoverished that home may be, you're walking into an extended family where the ties are close and where they are intimate, and where each person treats the other within the home with the utmost respect, where there's none of this, none of the children telling their parents how they should live and what their values should be, and where the parents treat the grandparents, however old, with utmost respect. These are, in a sense, reflexes of values which are implicit in Islamic society generally, but they are certainly values which the Jews of the Islamic world have picked up and made their own over a long period of time. Now, how did the educational system, how did the army try to integrate these Jews? By making them more Israeli than the Israeli. They did nothing in the school system except open the school system to them, insist that they come, provide them the wherewithal to come. But the problem is that when the young Ashkenazi boy went home, or girl went home, and asked her parents for help with a Hebrew lesson or a science lesson, the parents generally could help them. And when the young Sephardi went home and asked for help with a Hebrew lesson, his parents, who spoke Arabic or some Judeo-Persian or Ladino, a combination of Spanish and Arabic and Hebrew, could not help them, much less with the modern sciences. And so inevitably over the 50s and the 60s, the path of these children as they passed through the school system diverged. Israel requires what's called bagrut, a certificate of matriculation in order to enter into the universities. But by and large, the Sephardic community, which is growing larger and larger in terms of its numbers in the school system, they continue to have the very large families. These children were being diverted. They never got to the point where they could take the bagrut examination. Israel then decided to create a vocational school system parallel to the regular system. And most of the Sephardim fell into that system, which was essentially a dead end for blue-collar, menial kinds of jobs. And so by 1970, though the numbers of the Sephardim in the schools equaled by this time the number of the Ashkenazim in the school, only 7% of the university population was, in fact, of Sephardic origin. Now, by 1982 or 83, that number had risen to 20%. The number of the Sephardim in the schools was now over 70%. And so there is still that imbalance, the numbers who are not being given the extra kind of help and work required. In the middle 1960s, the school system began to try and provide some of this, what we would call remedial education, some of the supportive kinds of education. But it has not been easy. And over the years, because they have been shunted into low-level jobs, because they've been kept apart in these development towns, because everyone has insisted that they be Israeli, Ashkenazi, European, rather than simply Israeli Jews of Sephardi origin, the Sephardim have become more and more separate and more angry about what has happened to them. As a matter of fact, a certain kind of racism seems to have developed in parts of the Israeli society. There's an association of the Sephardim with color. After all, they come from the Arab world. Their skins are a little darker, more Semitic, if you will, than are those of Ashkenazic Jewry. A friend of mine, Rafael Israeli, who is himself a Sephardic Jew, was born in Morocco, but is very light-skinned, told me this story once. He was in a grocery store in Jerusalem, and two Ashkenazic Jews of the old school were having a violent argument over something in Yiddish. Now, Israeli has no idea what Yiddish is all about. But these two men were blocking the aisle. There was nothing he could do but stand there and listen. And finally, one of the men who had been arguing so violently ran out of steam towards his opponent, turned to Israeli, and he made the whole case, whatever it was, to Israeli again in Yiddish. And what can you do? Israeli sort of nodded, and he nodded along and nodded along to the whole thing. And instinctively, this man had assumed that he was a fellow Ashkenazi. And as soon as he ran out of steam, he'd made all of his points, he reverted to Hebrew, and he said to Israeli, "Where did you learn to speak such a perfect Yiddish?" When I was a chaplain in the Far East during the Korean War, there was a phrase which was used about the way some of the missionaries went about their work. They were what were called rice Christians. Rice Christians were those children of very poor Japanese families who were enticed to the missions by the promise made to the families that they would clothe them, feed them, the children, shelter children who otherwise could not be taken care of. Interestingly, in Israel, over the last 20 years, there's developed something which I guess we could call Hummus Jews. An inordinate amount of money has been given by the Jewish Agency and also given by Jews around the world to the Ashkenazic yeshivot in Jerusalem, Sfat, and elsewhere. And what these yeshivot have done is to go out and to find poor Sephardi families and to promise these families that they will take in their sons and provide them with food, clothing, and shelter. And then the family has really no alternative. And these Chumash Sephardi yeshivot students are taken into yeshivot where they're taught in Yiddish, the Ashkenazic way, the medieval ways of our ancestors 300 years ago on the European continent. And one of the tragedies which is afflicting Sephardic life in Israel is that it has not had the opportunity to develop its own natural traditional leadership. Now notice I use the word traditional rather than orthodox. The Sephardim never went through the emancipation. They never went through the battles that Western Jewry has gone through between those who are defiantly anti-religious and those who affirm the old tradition. Therefore, there is no orthodoxy among them. There is simply a universal respect for the tradition. That's almost unanimous among the Sephardic population. But it's a respect of a particular kind. It is not the anger at modernity that you see in Tel Shu Yeshiva. It is not the denial of the modern world that you can see in among the Neturei Karta in Jerusalem. It is rather an acceptance of the world and a natural acceptance of traditional Judaism that is somehow bridged, and the great figure in this is Maimonides, who in the 12th century taught the Sephardim that one could live with the best cultural teachings of the host culture, and one could live with the best practical and intellectual teachings of one's own culture, and that there was no essential difference between truth, if truth be truth. It's called the double faith theory. That if one analyzes truth, it is truth must be one. And therefore, one looks for the best in one's own culture, one looks for the best in the tradition, in the host culture, and one somehow weds these into a single unit. The kind of militant orthodoxy, which is warring today in Israel against everyone else in the Jewish community who does not see it its way, is unfamiliar as an attitude among the Sephardim. And yet because of these Chumash young yeshivot students, a generation of is being trained up in Israel, which I'm afraid is going to lead its own people, if they can be led, to adopt this kind of belligerency, which is so unfortunate, creating such divisions among us. What really concerns Ashkenazi Israel about the Sephardim? Certainly not that they're poor. Most Israelis came poor. Certainly not that they've been culturally deprived. The generation that came through the Holocaust came having had years taken away from their lives when they weren't in school, couldn't have the advantages of culture. It has to do with this whole historical attitude. The Ashkenazic Jews came to Israel, created the kibbutzim, created the istadrut, created universities, created all the institutions which they felt expressed the best of their vision. And they now feel that somehow this flood of Sephardim will undercut all that they have established. They don't want to give up their authority. And particularly in politics, and everything in Israel is political. Particularly in politics, there's an old boys' network at work which sees to it that the sons and the grandsons, the daughters and the granddaughters of the founders somehow retain the positions of power in all the institutions that count. Now, all this has been simmering for a long time and exploded in national concern, as a national concern after the election of 1977. That famous election in which the Likud under Menachem Begin for the first time unseated the Labor Party from control of the government of Israel since the very founding of the state. And those who analyzed the election made it very clear that the basis of Begin's success lay in the fact that the Sephardim had largely voted for him. Now, immediately, those who feared Begin and his non-socialist economics and also his political and foreign policies, immediately they assumed that the Sephardim had voted for Begin because they shared his militancy about Judea and Samaria's, that they were concerned with a foreign policy which started with a baseline, you'll never trust the Arabs, therefore you can never negotiate with the Arabs. The assumption was that because the Sephardim had lived in the Arab world, they knew exactly that they knew completely that the Arabs were untrustworthy, and therefore no negotiations would ever be meaningful. And the word went out that this new majority, the Sephardim, if allowed really to come to power, would make it impossible for Israel to remain a modern Western-oriented state. Unfortunately, the facts belie these concerns. If one looks at the zealots of the Gush Emunim, who went out and founded the illegal settlements in the West Bank, if one looks at the zealots who tried to plant bombs in the mosque at the top of the Temple Mount, if one looks at the followers of Meir Kahana with his racist anti-Arab policies, who does one see? Sephardim? Jews from the Mellahs of North Africa? Jews from Yemen, Jews from Iraq, not at all. We see young Jews from America. We see Jews who come out of our own community, largely, and some who come out of Western Europe, who are moved by a zealotry, born partially of the return to fundamentalism of our time, born partially out of a feeling that the Holocaust could happen again. We can trust only ourselves. Whatever be the reason, there are children, not Sephardi children. The children of the 20th century, not children of the 16th century. The Sephardim do not appear in any significant numbers among these zealots. There are children. And one looks at the reasons for the vote in 1977 and again in 1981 for the Likud by the Sephardim, we find that the basis is economic, and also that it was among the Likud, it was Begin's glory, that he recognized early on, 20 years before 1977, the potential of the Sephardic community, and he welcomed the best and brightest among them to his councils and to his party. While the labor group was denying entrance to David Levy, who applied to be a Labor Party official, Likud was willing to welcome these people and to work for the causes which they felt were economically, socially, and culturally necessary for them. And so in the last three elections, there has come into being a concerted Sephardi political force, and they know that they have the votes, and they are trying to find the ways to achieve what they think is necessary for them to enter in a complete way into the body politic, into the governance of Israel. Since everything in Israel is political, unless you have what Israelis call protexia, unless you can get to a politician and have him accomplish something for you, you're not going to get your apartment, you're not going to get your job, you're not going to even be able to establish your sports team. And so this is an absolute requirement for the Sephardim that they get political authority. And the Israelis are having difficulty adjusting to this. Some of it is cultural. Some of it is a fear that when these people come, they will transform these Western-oriented agencies into something quite different than the founding fathers intending them to be, and they probably will have an impact upon them. But if you look back into history, you find two things. The first is that one of the most unbecoming of Jewish traits, it's a human trait actually, is that we look upon those who are different than us, even if they be Jews, as somehow inferior. How long ago, after all, was it that if a German Jew had a child who said, I'm bringing home a girl, who is she? Well, she's from this Sephardic, from this Polish Jewish family. That family would say, you better think twice, that's an intermarriage. The Ostjuden, the Eastern Jew, the Polish Jew, the Hungarian Jew, the Romanian Jew, was a threat to the German Jew and looked down upon and held in contempt. And there was a pecking order You went from Germany to from Poland to Hungary, from Hungary to Romania, and God forbid you were a Bulgarian Jew. That was the bottom of the line. Somehow whoever we call Eastern is somebody worth looking down on. Oriental is a pejorative. The Chinese have had, they're the most Oriental people I know, they've had a civilization for longer than Jews have had a civilization, but somehow they're looked down on. Well, Sephardim are going to make changes in Israel. But as I look at Israel, some changes would be quite welcome. Most of the institutions the Israelis created were created with a kind of anger against the tradition, which is unbecoming and the necessary in a Jewish state. Many of the institutions are purely dehumanizing, technical, mechanical. And the Israeli society is certainly not one which one would call gracious or civilized in the sense of being mannerly. It's argumentative, highly individualistic, without any strong sense of the family. Certainly in these areas, something can be learned from the Sephardic world. If we go back over time, you'll find that in time, each of the great areas of Jewish life has contributed something to the wonderful tapestry which is Jewish history. I came across a reference in Josephus the other day. Josephus, of course, was a Palestinian Jew who was who was a traitor and then became the part of the court of the Roman emperor. And speaking with all of the arrogance of a Westerner, he's talked at one point of the Jews of Parthia, which means the Jews of the East, as barbarians. A student. Now, these are the Jews who are about to create the Talmud. These were the Jews who were about to create the basic substance of rabbinic Judaism. But to Josephus, they were barbarians. And that kind of attitude, which precludes our seeing the positive, and in the case of what's going to happen in Israel, the inevitable, precludes us from taking advantage of the best that the culture has to offer. The Sephardim in Israel need education. They need the opportunity to compete on equal terms, which means certain kinds of help that the normal family may give to a student, which their families at this point cannot always give. Interestingly, there's an international Sephardic educational committee, which is now giving fellowships and scholarships to about 1,000 or 2,000 of the best and the brightest young Sephardim each year to study in the great universities outside of Europe. More and more of the Sephardim are being coached in one way or another so they can adjust to the Israeli school system. Literacy is becoming universal among them. They're adjusting to the urban ways, which a society like Israel requires. But I hope in that adjustment they'll not lose their distinctiveness, because I think that we will all benefit from it. There is a becoming sense of modesty, of human relationships, of the aesthetic in the Sephardic world, which the Ashkenazic community has never really seen. I remember a Shabbat in Jerusalem. I went first to an Ashkenazic city, a synagogue, not one in Mea Shearim. I didn't go to see the animals in the zoo. I went to worship. And it was hubbub. It was chaos. Long, everybody was at his own pace, racing through the service. Some were obviously caught up in it, most were not. The minute the reading of the Torah began, they went out to talk on the steps of the shul. The next week, I went to a Sephardic synagogue of Moroccan Jews. Gorgeous service. It began with someone ascending the pulpit. Everybody was quiet. It was Kabbalat Shabbat, Friday night. And one by one, from one corner or another, is a little synagogue, a man would stand up and chant one of the chapters of the Song of Songs. One, another, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, absolute quiet. It was lovely. The most perfect opening for a Jewish service you can imagine. And there was a sense of Hadagat HaKodesh, the sanctity of the holy, which at least was satisfying to me, and I suspect would be to you in that service throughout. Much of the what makes a service of our own have meaning grows out of its Sephardic roots. Why do you think it is that so many of the Reform temples of the 1890-1930 period were made to look Sephardic, were made to look like buildings of the so-called Oriental world? Because that was a world which had a sense of high culture, which the Reformers of an earlier time wanted desperately to emulate. Well, are the Sephardim good or bad for Israel? They're there. Will they contribute to Israel? They will. Will Israel be different because of their presence? It will. Will the Israelis always like what's happening? It depends who the Israelis are. The Sephardim will love their new power, abuse it, and use it well. The Ashkenazim will find it difficult to share power, but that's the way of the world. And in many ways, I look forward to one thing out of all of this. I believe that the spirit of tolerance, which has been traditional in the Sephardic world, may ultimately be the solution to the religious problem which threatens to break Israel in two and break the Jewish people into many parts. Ashkenazic Jews of a certain right-wing Orthodox persuasion are fanatics. Everybody must do it their way. The Sephardim are traditional, prepared to make the adjustments as they've had to make for 1,000 years to life. And if that spirit can become the dominant one because of numbers in the traditionalist world, then certainly all of us can find ways of accommodating to the sense of the unity of Israel. But if the fanatics have their way and they turn the Sephardim into Ashkenazim, then, as I've suggested to you in the past, we're in for a very difficult passage. Amen.